Hi everybody, it's Dimna here. I hope you guys can all hear me very well. I'm actually in Adelaide at the moment and I'm on a hotel internet connection thing and I've paid for extra speed and whatever else, so I hope it doesn't cut out on me. I haven't had a great deal of success in the past, I might add, doing these from hotels, so just bear with me tonight, but welcome to everybody. Now, tonight is a question and answer night. So, as usual, I've got the questions that have actually been sent in, and we're going to go through those first. And if we have time, we'll go to some of the live questions after that. Now, the first question here is about, it's about FSR. Now, before we go on, sorry, I've got a little bit of a cold. I said, I have a property in, Holroyd Council, New South Wales. It's zoned R4, which I think means units, and it's 1 to 1.75 FSR. Now, I know I'm going to get a question, what's FSR? So I've put down the bottom here. There's a little example. Now, you can see just down the bottom there where I've got the cursor going round and round. It says there, this is an example I've just put on so that you know what FSR is. FSR stands for floor space ratio, okay? So if you had a site, this little calculation here shows you, if you had a site 600 square metres and a gross floor area, that's not how you spell it, but anyway, floor area of 300 square metres, the calculation for the FSR would, of course, be 300 divided by 600, which is 0.5. So you'd have a 0.5 to 1 FSR ratio. So that just shows you how to actually calculate it out. So I just put that there, as I said, to, oh my goodness, I've lost my questions. Hang on. Oh, there they are. All right. Now, the question then goes on to say, where are we? Two of my neighbor's house on the left side next to me sold to a builder for $1 million each in April of this year. I put my property for sale and the builder gave me an offer of 30% less than that of $700,000, even though it was an identical size and zone to the others. He probably already had the properties he wanted. So I've obtained independent valuation on my property and it's come in at 1.1. Now the council has received DAs from the left and right sides of my property. Yes, at the same time from different builders. I have called the council and they said they would not allow land locking. My question is, how do I get the maximum value for my lot? All right, what size was it? Did you say what size it was? No, you didn't say what size it was. Okay. Look, you need to determine what can be built on your property, and because there is already seems to be at least precedence in the area that other people or builders are trying to get development approvals through in the area, what I recommend you do is actually go and see a town planner. Now, what a town planner is going to do is they will tell you what you can do with your site. And, what the costs would be to actually get a development approval on your site. So that you really know its capacity, both on its own and also if it was combined with the others. Now, you've spoken to the builder on one side. It's probably worth speaking to the builder on the other side as well. And with all of these development applications, you're going to have a period where the council will probably, the development approval will have to put up notices for, neighbours' comment and things like that. And you can look at their plans, you can look at what they want to do. And if you feel that it is of detriment to your property, you can actually go and lodge an objection with the council. It's got to be within the required time commitments, etc. And provided it's a justifiable issue that you have, it will actually be taken into consideration. But I really highly recommend the fact that you go and talk to a town planner, because they're going to know what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, and whether, you know, you're just saying, oh, I don't like it, that's not going to be good enough. You know, you've got to have a reason that's got some town planning weight to it for it to actually be considered. It'll go through the process, but it won't really be considered. So that's the first thing. I really want you to go and do that. Talk to a town planner and start the negotiation process, you know, from there. I want you to talk to the builder on the other side that you haven't already spoken to. And I would also like you to consider going in and actually getting a development approval through yourself on your block. Now, development approvals tend not to cost very much. I mean, there's consulting fees and things like that. How much do you have to do? Actually, not a lot. The consultants do the job, but it all starts with that town planner, and they will refer you to all of the other specific consultants that you're going to need, like, you know, your land guys and your surveyors and your soil testing and your engineers and your architects and everybody else that you know needs to come into it. But they can step that out, that process out for you, and give you some indication of cost as well. And they would also be able to refer you to the people that they use in those consulting roles to get the job done. You'll find with a development approval through on your property, it's going to be worth more than it will be now. Provides a, you know, a good development that you're asking for, not something that's going to be uneconomical. That's where your town planner really starts to come into play. And I want you to, I want you to heed that advice. If you get a town planner that's, I don't know, a bit rude or doesn't seem to communicate well, or you just don't gel with, well, don't stop at that. Go and ask for the opinion of a couple of others. You know, don't just accept one. And I think that'll serve you fairly well. Okay, the next question is quite long. It says here, we're at a bit of a crossroads in our investing. Now, having sold off the lemon, they've renovated their PPR, we finally took the plunge and bought a cash flow positive property in a mining town. This property, I'll just move this up a little bit, this property was bought with threefold strategy planned: to renovate to increase the value and yield, to furnish to increase the yield, and three, to subdivide to pay down a debt and increase the net cash flow. The property is on a corner lot and able to be subdivided. Step one and two have now been completed, and we're looking at step three. The market has cooled recently in this town, as there is an layover now between various contracts, and the next round of coal seam gas contracts, so it must be in the Surat Basin probably, coal seam gas contracts being issued. All signs point to the future of this town as being positive. However, at the moment, the market has cooled until the next round of contracts for coal seam gas get released. And the dollar settles down around certain coal projects to be given green light. All right. We had this property tenanted for some time, but they have now handed notice to vacate, and our property manager advises lowering the rent. We are fine with that. 80% of something is worth more than 100% of nothing. However, we are debating about whether it will be a good idea to pursue the subdivision and try to sell the land, given the demand is possibly no longer there for land. Alternatively, we have the advantage with our property that it is a mixed use zone, and there is a potential to add storage units to the back. This would increase the rental yield, lifting it back to being cash flow positive. The downside is that it would leave us with higher debt exposure than we would like. We have run John's feasibility study for both scenarios above, as well as leaving the property as is. As mentioned, the difference lies in the cash flow versus debt levels. If we added storage units and did not subdivide and sell, we would be required to, we would required to JV our next deal, but we would be happy, would be happily cash flow positive. Subdividing and selling off the land will leave us cash neutral, but allow us to move on to our next deal without needing a joint venture, provided we can sell the land. Leaving it as is, it's a very long question, leaving it as is leaves the property just under cash neutral. The last option is not preferred for obvious reasons. All scenarios have their pros and cons, but none stand head and shoulders above the others. We are also considering sitting on our hands for a month or two, as there is news of new work being contracted out soon, bringing the yields back up. In the meantime, we have offered the property on a non-contract term lease. Any advice you could offer on which direction we could take is appreciated. P.S. We know what Ian would say. If it stops you doing the next year deal, then it's the wrong choice. But cash flow is important to us too, to increase our serviceability on future loans. All right. Well, let's go right back up to the beginning, first of all. Now, we're talking about the coal seam gas, and I'll just give you a little bit of an update on that first of all. Our future contracts are good. The overseas buyers of those contracts are strong. Their need is increasing, not decreasing. And with any mining exposure, you're going to get, particularly ones that are virgining, like this one, like coal seam gas, what you're going to see is that it will fluctuate quite considerably until you get into that normal operational stage. And coal seam gas is not there yet. It's still in construction operation. So you're going to continue to get some, a little bit more liquidity going up and down with that kind of stuff. Now, I do believe it is strengthening, and I do believe it's strengthening relatively quickly, as in within the next 6 months. So it's not something I would be panicking about by any stretch of the imagination. I actually feel that sitting on your hands for a few months probably wouldn't hurt, although I would like you to start working on the subdivision process to really get the costs down, who you're going to use, how long it's going to take, and even maybe go on a bit of a go slow boat basis with that. I think without the subdivision, you won't get the value of the property up for you to be able to refinance and do anything else, so you'll be stuck for a little bit. I think adding storage sheds will stymie you unless it's on a separate title. I mean, if you can subdivide and then put the storage sheds on, that may work out profitably and you'll have to do your figures on that. But without the subdivision, the value of your property probably won't go up enough for you to be able to refinance and go on and do the next deal adequately. So you've got to be conscious of building equity as well as cash flow. Now, as I say, sitting on your hands, I actually think is the best option for another, few months at least, till probably maybe even 6 months, just to see what happens out there. But I do feel it is strengthening, and I think you'll see a very different market in a few months' time. Having said that, I don't think if you do subdivide that the land will even then be particularly saleable. You may be able to subdivide and then do a joint venture on the land to build or something like that, because I feel that that is the best option to actually move the block along. I don't think land, raw land, will sell particularly well. I think it's going to be a built premises of some description. Now's a good time for you to be actually be doing the all the work on the property, working out what's going to be required, what style of housing, is it a single family house, is it a duplex you can fit on there, what's going to be needed, are they one bedders, are they two bedders, are they threes, are they fours, what are they? and really start, you know, spending your time the next little bit investigating and knowing exactly what you're going to go and do. My tendency would be to actually do the subdivision because I think that will give you your uplift in value, but I don't think you're necessarily going to be able to sell the land. So there may be a student even listening now that you know, may want to contact you on it. You can probably put your details up on the deal of once you get it worked out as to how it might work for a joint venture on the subdivided block, you know, to be able to get out there and build and then sell off. Or, you know, you might be able to sell it off for somebody who wants some exposure out there and perhaps hasn't got the equity to go into it. So, for instance, say I was somebody who was on a good salary, but I didn't have any equity, and you go ahead and do the subdivision on the deal. Something that might work for both parties is I might be a student and I might contact you and say, look, would you vendor finance me the deposit on the land, let's say, because if I've got a good salary, you know, I'll be able to go and get a construction loan to build something on there, but I don't have the deposit for it. So that you might vendor finance them 20% with a contract. Obviously, everything has to be written down in contract, you know, signed off by the lawyers, all of that kind of stuff. But then the joint venture partner builds the house, you know, has it revalued, et cetera, and at least it's going to come up to cost, it'll probably come a little bit more than that, and be able to revalue and then pay you that money back. So, you know, that's something that I think could work all round. Hang on. Oh, sorry, I thought I was going to sneeze. Sorry, I've got a little bit of a cold, so if I'm sounding a little bit croaky, just bear with me. I was just about to sneeze. But as I say, that's something that that I would be considering on that one. It's not a race. You don't have to feel that you have to get out there and, you know, start the next thing, so, you know, really, really quickly, et cetera. But that'll certainly give you the ability to be able to be moving along with things and really getting all your costings worked out, everything, your subdivision, et cetera, won't cost that much comparative to other strategies of buying a new property and all those sort of things. And, you know, a joint venture on the construction for another student who, as I say, the ideal student to approach you and say, look, I've got a great salary, you know, I want cash flow and you know, be able to make some money on something, would be for you to vendor finance them the deposit on that property. But make sure it's all tied up legally, like I say. So I actually think that's the best move on that particular one. Okay, the next one here says, we've purchased a block that we could do a 4-unit seniors living development on. However, we would have to sell them all since if we held them, the yield would be terrible. Have to be rented to over 55s. We have purchased. Okay, so you've already bought it. The profit from selling, however, would be good, approximately $400,000 before tax. We have not done a development like this before, but have the skills and experience and financial backing now to be able to do it. We would be building them ourselves. We can make the same profit from running our building business in approximately 3 years, though if we build them, that would take a year, so we would only be 2 years behind. You'd actually be 2 years in front, not behind. However, equally, we could granny flat the block and hold for the long term, which would be neutral after everything, including land tax. So it must be New South Wales. If rates rise, however, it would be negative, though we currently have a passive income of $70,000 per annum from property. We are in a relatively strong position to hold. In the medium term, the block will certainly be subdividable, at which point we would build two houses and two granny flats, with the option to sell one or both or continue to hold. At this stage, we are thinking to hold for the long term to benefit from capital growth, as I think our walk away profit today would be dwarfed by long term growth. but we are disappointed not to be doing the development and gaining the learning experience from it. If we hold, we can still move on, but only on a much smaller scale than we would be able to develop and sell. Appreciate your thoughts. All right. This one is an interesting one, actually, because first of all, I question why a four-unit development could only be sold to over 55s. It must be in an over 55s community. Now, if it's in an over 55s community, I then question whether you can actually then subdivide and put a house and a granny flat on if you're not then having to rent to over 55. So I'm just going to duck across to the questions over here, and I'll see if there's anything that's come in about that, Jennifer. I'll just whiz down and see if your name's here. If you'd like to tell me a little bit more about it, I'd appreciate it, because that kind of doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. No, there's nothing there from you. Okay. Well, what I would you've got to do the feasibility, first of all. You're going to have to work out each strategy as you've pinned it out there and work out what your dollar figures are. You've got to look at the area and say, okay, how much is this area really growing? So how much would these properties be worth in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, et cetera? And work out, you know, what your options are. However, don't forget, though, that, you know, making money now, if you made, say, $400 in a year, that $400 that can then go back into the market to go in and do another thing. You really need to test, though, before you go and build four units on there, you really need to be talking to the sales agents about what your what the revenue is that you're actually going to get, how quickly they will sell. And I would imagine you'd probably have to get pre-sales before you even start construction. So the first thing is that I would be out there talking to the agents about what's going to sell. Actually, Jennifer's just come back and said the four units can only be built on the land under a seniors SEP scheme. Okay, so it is New South Wales. But you're able to do two houses that don't then come into that scheme. It's interesting. All right. Well, you need to work those figures out on each strategy. And just speaking from experience, when you've got a limited market, such as an over 55s only, as an example, they are harder to sell. Now, if there's a exceptionally high demand for over 55s and there isn't a lot around, etc., then you may be fine, and you may be able to sell them off and make that within good sales, etc. And the way to test that is to run a little bit of an ad campaign and offer them for sale. And I know you haven't got them even built yet, but just to see what kind of response you actually get, and see how strong the demand is. You've said here that there is a strong demand for them, and you know at the pricing they will sell. All right, well, if you want to do a development, you're going to make $400,000. You can easily do that. If you want to do the houses, then can you tell me what area it's in, Jennifer? Just tell me quick. I won't read it out, but if you can tell me what area it's in, I perhaps can give you a little bit more advice on growth. So just shoot me a little quick chat thingy on what area it's in, and I'll talk about growth generally, because that's the question. You know, $400,000 now versus more later on, but then if you hold it now, you've got to then, you know, you're doing a lesser project next. I reckon money in the bag's money in the bag. You know, if you reckon you can get pre-sales and sell them off now, you've got a guaranteed $400,000. The banks will finance that. You can be into your next deal very quickly anyway. And if the next deal's a different subdivision, well, so be it. So, you know, the only thing you're really tossing up there is whether it's whether the growth is going to expand or not. All right. The area that you've said is in Sydney, and yes, there is going to be more growth in that area in Sydney. So you just got to do the numbers. That's all it comes down to. You know, if you put in probably a 7% growth in that area over the next 12 months, and you know, is the demand still going to be strong in 12 months' time for that style of product? I would tend to say yes. Can you afford to hold it for 12 months? How that's going to affect you, because you're not going to go and do another deal. Whereas conversely, if you got pre-sales on it and you actually built it and sold it, you could be into another deal in the same area relatively quickly. So if it was me, if the units make you more money than the houses and a granny flat, I'd probably do the units and be looking for my next block straight away. Get the pre-sales in place, get the financing in place, and be straight out there, you know, securing my next block, which might be a different kind of deal. If the houses will make you just as much money by building two houses with two granny flats, would make you, you know, similar kind of money. So it makes you, it increases the equity by say 300, and you've got good availability to be able to rent it and all that sort of stuff. And, it, you know, with the two granny flats, it's going to be positive. And you don't need the passive income, which you probably don't with $70,000 worth of passive income coming in. I'd do the two houses, two granny flats, and just keep it, because the long-term growth in that area will be very, very good. You and I both know that. So if you don't need income, do the two houses, two granny flats, and keep it. But get them done quickly and revalue, because I think you're missing the point here that you know, you think you're going to be stopped from going and doing the next deal, but you're not, because as soon as those things are finished and you revalue, you'll get all your money back to go again anyway. So it's more of a, you know, do a chunk deal for sell, or do you do a chunk deal for hold? Now, the other consideration that comes into place here is how much personal debt have you got? Because if you've got a lot of personal debt and, you know, you really need to bring your personal debt down, then build the units, sell them and make the 400 grand, pay your taxes and, you know, pay off your debts. But if you're reasonably comfortable, as you seem to be, because you've got, you know, 70 grand passive income coming in anyway, you don't have to have passive income. You know, building two new houses in that very good area in Sydney, with neutral to positive cash flow, that's good. And if interest rates go to 10% and it's negative and you can't afford to hold it, sell one of them, keep the other one. So I hope that helps. Does that help, Jennifer? You can send me through a little bit of a thing there and I'll have it. You reckon that they'll sell quickly? That's good. And the last little thing there is subdivision can't be done now. I'm banking on it in the future. Oh, okay. So you can't actually subdivide right now. Well, how much debt have you got? If you got a lot of debt, I would say that I would be doing the units and then paying down my debt. If you haven't got a lot of debt, and you could, you know, one house and one granny flat's not going to keep it neutral. I'd be talking to a town planner to see whether there's any way. If you can't do a subdivision, you can probably do a strata. So I'd be talking to a town planner as to whether you can actually strata the units as well. So that's the next thing I'd be looking at as well. Hope that helps. You could hold them neutrally with a granny flat for now. Well, you know, if you don't need the cash flow, granny flat's not going to increase the value of the property very much, other than what you put on it. You know, a subdivision will, a new construction will. It'll get you your money back and build your equity. But just putting a granny flat on will not increase the value of your property much more than having the cost of the granny flat returned to you. That'll be all. So you really need to, you need to move on it more than that, or you need to be able to work out a way where you can get your two houses and maybe have a strata rather than a subdivision, because that certainly could be possible. So talk to your town planner about that and see where you go. Okay, the next question down here says, in April of 2012, I formed a self-managed superannuation fund of myself, my two sons, and a stranger. Ooh, that's unusual. The fund lent $100,000 to a corporate trustee. That's unusual as well, which lent to a joint venture. That's even more unusual. I hope you got this check by a superannuation fund specialist, because I'm not particularly liking it at the moment, but get it checked. Of which you and another person were 50-50 ownership. The agreement was to purchase the land in Gladstone for $1 million with the extended settlement, do a DA and sell 1 year and to sell in 1 year and 2 weeks. The promise was 200% return on investment. It's pretty high. However, there was no end date indicated on the agreement. Gosh, I'm just seeing holes here everywhere, Violetta. You've got to have this stuff tied up, airtight, with your own lawyers, really looking at, you know, how it's protecting you. I'm not even sure that what you've done up there with the self-managed superannuation fund is actually kosher. I'm not saying it's not, but I don't know that it is, and I want you to get that checked by a superannuation fund, self-managed superannuation fund specialist. My joint venture partner was handling all the work. However, the expiry date of the agreement, I was simply told that the property prices dropped substantially and there was no good enough return on investment if sold. So she made her decision to do a development of 16 units, and I have to wait for another year to get my money back, as there was no money left due to all the costs involved prior. I indicated that it was a breach of the agreement, as I was not informed about the different turn in course. However, another year has gone by, but the prices were not moving. She wants to extend our agreement as if I have to sign the docs of extension, not to lose the money, and there is no money to pay me back. I want out. Is there any way I can do that? You need two things. You need to go to a self-managed super fund specialist. Now, I would actually recommend that you go and see Clint at Investor Loans Network. He's specialised now in superannuation. He is very good with it. He's got his financial planning qualifications, as well as obviously his lending and other things. So I need you to double check that what you've done is kosher, for starters. The second thing is I need you to get the contract reviewed, the extensions, the contract, what's the legality, all that stuff. So I need you to if you haven't got a lawyer, I would like it to go to Pacific Law, because I trust them, I know them, and I know that they'll be acting in your best interest. So get that agreement, get that contract to them so that they can review it, see what can be done. You're going to have to do a search on this other person's assets to see if you have any claim over her and what that might look like. And go from there. You're in a position now where you really have to look at the legal side of things. So get in front of Pacific Law, get in front of Clint to get the superannuation stuff reviewed, and then I'm going to feel a lot more comfortable, because they're the only ones that can answer that question for you, Violetta. It's coming down to legal agreements and that sort of thing. This is why this stuff has to be squeaky clean when you go into it. Don't go into anything. I was talking to Ian the other day. He was speaking to somebody that went into something that, the agreements weren't in place and didn't have the documentation and the joint venture agreement and this and that. That is so, so dangerous. I don't care how much you trust them. I don't care how much of a mate they are. Please get all of those agreements tied up right up front, because when things start to go wrong, it's a bit late to be thinking about anything else. All right, it's too late to be signing contracts then too. All right, I'm doing a splitter project in Brisbane City Council area. The DA has been approved for the subdivision, but titling can't be done until the existing house is slid across the block, okay? The council is saying that the small lot code does not apply re acceptable setbacks until the block is subdivided, but the house cannot be slid until council or a private certifier approves it. The to-be-subdivided block is not wide enough for the house to fit under standard building code setbacks in the BCC building code. Feel like a chicken and an egg situation. Do you have any advice or how to move forward on this? I have never heard of this one before. But I tell you what I would do. And again, I'm going to sound like a squeaky wheel, but you've got to go and talk to a town planner. And you've got to talk to not one, but two or three or four or five or six. I'd be talking to private certifiers as well, and I would be really collating all the advice that they give you and, you know, putting that together and seeing, you know, where that leaves you and what your options are with that, because you'll probably find a private certifier that'll be able to do it with conditions regarding the new subdivision, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, this is a silly situation where there must be a resolution to it. You know, it'll be something that you can resolve. You've just got to, you know, you just got to work out a way. And I don't know. I don't know the solution to this one, but I would be hounding town planners and private certifiers and the council planning department all over the place to, you know, to come up with a solution for it. Off the top of my head, there's nothing I can actually think of other than, you know, a conditional agreement to move or something like that. The other thing is, I guess, if anything like that fails, you could move the house to a temporary yard somewhere, get the subdivision in place, and then put the house back. That's going to cost you more, but it may not be that much more. I would use that as my last resort. You know, there's plenty of house graveyards around the place that you can use to you know, to house it for a while. They're probably the people that are going to move it for you anyway, and just see where that leaves you, and you know, go from there. It would be a solution. It's probably not my preferred solution. But if nothing else fails, you would be able to do that, just end up costing you a little bit more. Hope that helps. Oh, that's it. Okay, then. Well, let me find the other questions. Where are they? There they are. You probably can't see the questions, but I can. They're hidden behind. So I'll just bring Jennifer's question back up so that you can actually see it. And I will bring up this. There we go. If I move that right over there, I should be able to see it over here. Oh, sorry, guys. Just bear with me for a minute. I'm fiddling around. Here we go. All right. Well, I can read the questions. I don't think you can, but anyway. The first question says, is that my first question? Hang on. No, it's not. All right. The first question says, I have no job. But do have some money to invest. Okay. Well, there's not much of a question there, but anyway. You know, what can you do? Well, depending on how much money you've got to invest, you could start to look at doing deals for cash. I would, you know, until you've got some rungs on the board there, you could start to do deals for cash. And, you know, after... Well, worst case scenario, after a maximum of 2 years, you're going to end up with a track record of making money from what you do in real estate, and they will actually count that income as your income, you know, the chunk money income as your income for tax purposes. But it will take time to do that, obviously. If it's not enough for that, you could look at buying some of the high-yield properties, maybe in the mining towns and things like that, where you're buying immediate cash flow, and then the banks will then use that for security, for serviceability, for you to be able to get out there and go into your next project and whatever else. So that's an alternative. The second thing is you could joint venture with somebody who does have a job, and that might even be the easiest thing to go and do, is to joint venture with someone who's got a high income to be able to go and do a go and do a deal where you make some money and you move on and go back to the next thing. And I wouldn't do a deal where you end up in a cash flow deal that you've got to stay together forever and ever and a day. I'd probably do a chunk deal where you can get out there, get a chunk of money going, and then finish that deal and then go on and go to the next deal. So there's some options for you. If you haven't been to a boot camp yet, I want to see you at the next boot camp, though, because I go through a lot of those strategies. Networking at the boot camp with other like-minded individuals would be very, very good for you anyway. And the other thing you could do is you could advertise on the forum that you're in that situation, and people with high incomes might like to contact you and see if you can come up with a deal together. Make sure, though, that you do your due diligence on the deal. I don't vet the deals. Make sure that you get a second and third opinion on things so that you're not led down the garden path by anybody. All right, the next question here says, in case we have time, who and how can we claim for the cost of setting up the trust and corporate trustee? Can the trust claim the cost to create itself? And can I call it a loan to the trust? You can certainly call it a loan to the trust. So when, from tax paid money, you can actually reimburse yourself for that, but not from pre-tax money. It's not a deduction, but it'd certainly be reimbursed, and there's no tax implication coming back to you. As far as being able to claim as a tax deduction, I don't believe you can. It'll go in the balance sheet as a formation expense. However, I might just get clarification on that, because you can shoot a little email through to Tash at Grow Accounting there. Share details are on the website as well, because I've got this little thing in the back of my mind that there might have been a tax law change on that, that there was something that you could actually claim it, like depreciate it over a period of time or something. So shoot a little email through to Tash on the next one, through to Tash if you want to on that one there. And the other thing I'll do is I'll clarify with Tash as well, and I will let you know exactly what the ruling is on the next webinar, which won't be a Q&A webinar. It'll be my teaching webinar, but I'll make sure I'll cover that for you. Okay, the current question. That one there's on the corner block. The one that was whether to subdivide or not. It says we have a similar property. Just move this so I can read it. Similar property that could have storage sheds, but not sure what. Following on from that, because it's a different person. It's got a property that could have storage sheds on it, but not sure what these would cost to build and where you would go to get designs, as there must be a pretty common design. Yeah, they're pretty easy. It kind of depends. I mean, if you're going to put up corrugated iron ones, well, they don't cost a lot to build at all. It's really more the cost of the slab. If you go to BMT, which is a depreciation company that does quantity surveyors, they are, and they do depreciation schedules and things like that, they actually have schedules of what things cost. So everything from, concrete right down. And when you look at it, basically there's concrete you're going to have to cover pretty much the entire site with. That's roughly $55 a square meter, but, go and look it up for yourself. And then it depends on the construction, whether you're using block construction, lightweight construction, or whether you're using, corrugated iron construction. And again, BMT or Archi Centre is another one. They've actually got a lot of the standardised costing on there that you can download for yourself, and go and have a look and see what estimate it out. You can draw it out. It depends on what size it is. Draw it out. See what square meters they'd be. And those two websites will certainly be able to help you with what the how much it would cost to actually get that done. Okay, the next one here is with the Surat Basin area. I'm in the same position, and I think in the same area as you previous letter. And I'm thinking of starting the DA process at the moment too, getting ready. for good operational stages and coal, et cetera, in the next 5 years. I think that's wise. I really do. Can't read that next word. Do you think this is the place to start? Excuse me. Sorry. It's jolly cold. Yeah, I do. I do think that's wise. I think it's a strengthening area, not a weakening area. I think you're going to see a lot more strength and consolidation in that area over the next few years. I don't think it's going to be a runaway train. I think you're going to see some slow strengthening, which would be good. The next lot of contracts I don't think are very far away. And I also feel that the coal in that area as well will happen. Again, I don't think it's going to be quick, but it will happen. And if you've got positions in there, I think you'll thank yourself for having them in, you know, 5 years' time, because I think you'll see a lot of strength out of that general area. It says, we have manufactured growth, adding a granny flat on a Pilbara property, and it has now been empty for 3 months. We have lowered the rent to the market. And still haven't got any interest on it. We have also found that people are, Indigenous people living across the road having gatherings, which scares potential tenants off. What is the approach to fix this? There again, it's going through a little bit of a lull, but it's strengthening. Granny flats are all, in these regional areas, are certainly going to be a weaker rental than a place where you've got your own backyard and your own security and all of that kind of stuff. Fencing does help. As far as areas go violence or police intervention and things like that, the best thing to do is to, is to inform the police as to what's going on. Talk to the council about it as well, and they can put restrictions and other things on there. I also know that a lot of the community housing in the Pilbara area generally is being upgraded, so you can talk to community housing departments up there about what their plans are regarding that sort of thing. And they do take seriously any complaints from neighbours around, if there has been violence or problematic tenants in their community housing. So I recommend you, you contact them as well and keep in close contact with them. One of my platinum students actually had a very good outcome with the Department of Community Services, where they actually told him about future plans of completely redevelopment and things like that, with new houses going in, and splitting it up between ownership and rentals, which seems to be the way that they're going. But you need to contact them and talk to them. As far as rentals go, look, you just keep the rents going down until such time as you've got the rent that you actually require on it. Keep in close contact with the agents up there. Keep in good contact with the agents, and make sure that you've got good relationships there. So that if somebody came along and said, "Oh, well, look, I'd rent it if it was furnished," as an example, hopefully they would ring you and say, "Look, if you want to put some furniture in there, because I've got somebody to go in, they just don't have any furniture," all that kind of stuff. And furnishing on a granny flat actually is not a bad idea in these areas, because you're likely to pick up the one that hasn't got, moved to the area, isn't established, all that kind of stuff, into a granny flat, and they can just walk in there and everything's done for them. They've got their own space, that kind of stuff. So fencing is another thing, if you can fence off an area, because a lot of these places people want their own pet. I'd talk to the agents in those areas about that as well, and talk to them as to what the opportunities are, or the benefits or the demand for that kind of stuff. Okay, the next question here is, can you provide the name and details of the superannuation person you recommended? Clint Ducat is his name. Clint Ducat, he's with Investor Loans Network. If you go onto the website under referrals to professionals and you look up Investor Loan Network and look for Clint Ducat his details specifically. He is he's qualified financial planner as well as a mortgage strategist, and he specialises in superannuation. So he'd be the one that I'd actually talk to there. Samantha says she had $300,000 to invest, nothing left bar the $300,000. Okay. Well, Samantha, my same applies there, but, you know, you said you're a new student. I'd really want you at the next boot camp. I don't want you to rush into anything because I think a lot more will become clear once I've got you at the next boot camp. So I'll see you in September, October, depending on what city you're in. We have cleared 90% of our personal and business debt. Sorry, pushed the wrong button. Didn't get it. Sorry, don't know what that means. All right. The next one here is we have a subdivision application with the council for 6 months now, using a well-known company in the area. That must be in relation to the one I just talked about before. I'm curious about the term under market value. Under what conditions would this actually occur? If I'm looking to purchase a property and my offer is accepted, is a low offer, surely this is the market value, Alex. You know, look, there is some conjecture about that, you know, if you've got a property that, you know, you buy it at a certain value and you know, surely that's the market value. And, look, there is an argument for that. However, if you could turn around and with a controlled, well-marketed sale get more than what you paid for it or revalue it for more than what you've paid for it within a, you know, a short space of time, I would argue that you've bought it under market value. I'll give you an example. I was talking to a friend of a chap who has just gone through divorce. He's had to short sell a property because of the divorce, and he had to short sell another property because he was moving out of an area and whatever else, and the property had actually dropped in value. And he's got a property going to auction this weekend. It's in the Gold Coast. No, I'm not going to say where it is or anything else. But, you know, he reckons he's going to have to sell it for, you know, about $100,000, whereas 6 months ago he might have been able to sell it for $500,000 or $600,000. There's no reserve on that property. So, you know, if people don't turn up at the auction, if it's a, you know, it hasn't been a well-marketed campaign, and it hasn't because it's a divorce sale and it's a rush sale, you know, that property's going to go for under market value. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, I would consider as, you know, that's the type of thing that you actually look for. David's actually put up the website for BMT, and it's www. This is that quantity surveyor I was talking about before that has all of the building you know, standardized building costs and things like that on there. It's www.bmtqs, so BMT Quantity Surveyors, it stands for, .com.au. Thank you, David, for giving me that. I've got a bit of a cold. I can't remember things at the moment. Okay, the next one here says, we were told that the boards out the front and letters to the surrounding properties are beefing sent out this week. Oh, being sent out this week. Okay, great. Talk to them. That was in relation to that previous question. I've got so many questions here. I can't actually see them all when I'm answering the other questions. All right. Recently, I have received some emails in regards to positive cash flow functions. I attended one of them by Cashflow Capital. They have some US investment opportunities in Texas for about $50,000 per property and about $5,000 to $10,000 per year residual income. Have you come across any experience with investing with these properties in the US? If you have about $200,000 to invest, do you recommend we should try the US Texas properties in Australia? Okay, well, the first thing is, if you're going to invest in the US, I really highly recommend you come along and do my US program. I haven't specifically bought any US properties with cash flow capital. I do, however, quite often use them for sourcing properties here in Australia. Make sure you do your own due diligence on absolutely everything, whether they're in the US or here, and that you're entirely comfortable on every situation there. So, the Australian program that I do will certainly help you with structures and a whole lot of other things, as well as access to my buying group in the US that I use to buy my properties in the US. And then that gives you the opportunity then to compare both and to go from there. So that would be my recommendation on that one there. I've heard of depreciation, the setup costs over 5 years. I've heard you can depreciate the setup costs over 5 years. Okay, that's it. That's the other one. I'll answer that one there next week. I just want to check something on that one before I give you a definitive answer. Where can I find positive cash flow in Australia? You need to come to one of the boot camps. Not something I'll do right here. There are a number of webinars that I've done on positive cash flow, but it's more about the strategy that you put into place rather than the actual areas. So by the tone of your question there, we're not far off the boot camps. I want you to come to boot camps, and then I'll answer all that there for you as well, because it's a little bit more of an in-depth question than just I'll go here, go there, etc. Next question here is, we are currently living in one of our properties that is owned in a trust structure. Do I need a rental agreement between us and the trust? Do I need to pay rent into an account in the same name as the trust? And if so, does it have to be at market value, or can it just be an amount to cover the interest-only repayments? The difference between the interest and the repayments and the current market value rental is approximately $130 to $150 a week. Because it's in a trust, you actually don't have to have it at market value. However, there is a tax ruling there called 2167, tax ruling 2167, which basically says you can't get a tax benefit for renting your property in a trust and creating a negative cash flow that you can offset against other things. So you can't do any of that. However, having said that, you can have you can rent off your trust, and if you only want to pay enough to cover the repayments, you can do that. There, Division 7A does not apply to trusts; it only applies to companies, so you're not covered under that. So that's certainly something that you can do. Now, guys, I'm going to call it quits there. Any other questions that I haven't been able to get to, can you please write them up in a question? And as you can see, anything that's written through in the written questions, I cover first, and they will always be answered. The others, it'll only be a matter of if we can actually get time to go through them. So, guys, thank you so much for bearing with me. I hope the audio has been okay, and sorry about the sneezing, etc. I also look forward to seeing everybody in Adelaide. If you're around tomorrow, I'm going to be in Adelaide doing a one-dayer in Adelaide, so see you then. And thanks heaps, guys, and I'll be back again to talk to you in a couple of weeks' time with a training webinar. So thanks, guys. Catch you again next time. Bye for now.